Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, and it's Billy Joel's Pressure fading out in the background, as always. This is the episode of June 10, 2021. I am still coming live from Amsterdam in the Netherlands. That will also actually be a topic later in this episode. I have a great episode for you today. Hopefully you are enjoying the nice weather over Western Europe in these days. Hopefully the rain is not coming back too quickly. Hope you're also enjoying that less and less countries seem to have lockdown rules, so that's enjoyable as well. My guest in this week's episode is İsrafil Özkan. He is the director of the Turkish Public Alcohol Policy Watch, based in Ankara, Turkey. So we are chatting about alcohol rules in Turkey and how they affect the days and lifestyles of average consumers. Also in this episode, I'll be talking about the new proposals by the G7 for a minimum tax on companies. And I'm reporting to you from the demonstration of the World Vapors Alliance in The Hague, which is the administrative capital of the Netherlands. The Netherlands is trying to ban vape flavors. This is liquids for e-cigarettes that have specific flavors. And so we'll be talking about that with one of the activists on the ground who was there and who has a fascinating story to tell. So stay tuned for that. Also stay tuned. The end of this episode, we will have the interview with İsrafil Özkan. But first, of course, I want to talk about this minimum tax proposal that the G7 have introduced. This was over the weekend. Here's the BBC reporting.
In the past hour, the British Chancellor Rishi Sunak has announced that the G7 group of leading economies have reached what he called an historic agreement to reform the global tax system. The deal includes a global minimum corporation tax of at least 15% and aims to ensure global multinational companies, including big tech giants, will pay what Mr. Sunak described as the right tax in the right places. Our business correspondent Katie Austin reports.
How much tax should multinational companies, particularly tech giants, pay, and where should they pay it? Those were the questions at the heart of these discussions between G7 finance ministers. Today, a consensus to back a global minimum rate of at least 15%.
I'm delighted to...
So basically, this tax proposal that the G7 has cranked out is based on two pillars. One is the minimum tax pillar. This means that countries all around the world are expected to increase their corporation, so this is their corporate income tax, to 15%. This means that some countries which have zero corporate income tax will have to introduce one, and some other countries like Ireland in Europe, and there's other European countries also involved, that will have to increase their corporate income tax. The other part is that more and more they want to tax companies where they actually operate. So this is in order to avoid for companies to base themselves in low tax jurisdictions and trying to avoid some of the taxes that are being imposed on them. Of course, we already have indirect taxes like this. This one is called value added tax. This is every time you go into a shop and you buy something, you do pay in most European countries, it's 20%, something around 20% that you pay. For me, in Luxembourg, it's 17%, and some other countries, they have much higher rates. So you do already pay those, but of course, more ought to be introduced according to the G7. I, of course, am not a fan of this kind of rule, as you can imagine, because the costs of these taxes are passed down to consumers. Consumers end up paying these taxes. I keep saying this over and over again. Companies do not actually pay taxes. The building cannot pay taxes. The floor won't pay taxes. That's not how that works. There's only three actors in a company that can actually pay taxes. So it's either you reduce the dividends of the shareholders, or you increase prices for consumers, or that's the third option, you can reduce the salaries of the workers who work for those companies. Usually it is the consumers that end up picking up the tab. And that, of course, is not fair, especially because it's the kind of tax that you don't really see. At least with indirect taxation through value-added tax, you see it on your receipt. You can actually identify what the problem is. Of course, with these taxes, that's not the case. I talked about something similar in last week's episode about the emissions trading system of the European Union. Again, similar problem, non-identifiable taxes for consumers directly. The other problem, of course, is the implementation. How exactly are we going to implement this? What are we going to suggest that we do to countries that refuse to introduce a corporate income tax or that say that they don't want to increase it. What are we going to do? Are we going to sanction these countries? Are we going to say we cannot do any business? Companies that want to do business in countries that are applying the rules, they cannot do any business in countries that do not apply it. That, of course, would be a significant reduction in global trade, and also gets mixed up quite significantly in the sovereign power that is taxation for each and every country. Of course, on the other hand, I do think it's super hypocritical, because simultaneously the countries that have the highest rates are also the ones that are very keen on subsidizing their industries. I mean, we have an entire conversation right now between the European Union and the United States about tariffs on certain goods, but we also have a conversation over subsidies, and we have an entire fight in the World Trade Organization, because both the European Union and the United States are subsidizing their aircraft manufacturers. So this is Boeing and Airbus. Both are being subsidized. So, of course, you can say, well, you need to raise your taxes and so on. But then, on the other hand, the countries that tax the most are also the one that give significant subsidies. And they're not taking this into account. They could say, well, let's create a fairer environment by reducing all these protectionist subsidies. That's what the World Trade Organization is supposed to do. But of course, that doesn't sell as well as going in front of TV and saying that you are going to be the one increasing corporate income tax. I heard the French Minister of the Economy, Bruno Le Maire, and he was also explaining that, oh, how very French it is that we don't give up and we are able to create all these new taxes. You know, usually if you want to be proud about something that your country creates, it should be an invention or liberalizing certain social institutions. But of course, France, very happy about taxing all of us more. And of course, that for this purpose of political bargaining and political grandstanding on something that they had absolutely no right to do, at least in my mind. I think tax competition is good. Companies and countries need to be happy about the fact that there is tax competition. If there wasn't tax competition, that would only embolden countries to increase it. Like, nobody says we need to have a global maximum rate for corporate taxation. So it is all about generating more revenue, because more revenue means more power for politicians and for governments, and it means less power and less decision making for consumers. So that's why I think this minimum tax proposal is very bad. But let's continue then with the other topic that I have this week for you. I went to The Hague, which is the administrative capital of the Netherlands. And there was a protest organized by the World Vapers Alliance in conjunction with other organizations on the ground. And it was in front of the Dutch Parliament protesting a ban on vape flavors. This is liquids for e-cigarettes. And of course, if you're a consumer of vape products, you know that there's a bunch of fancy flavors. And the point of these flavors is to get rid of the tobacco taste. But of course, the Dutch government thinks that this is not great. We should get rid of these different flavors. And that's why they suggest this flavor ban, which unfortunately seems to be going through the institutions in the Netherlands. Of course, the European Union also interested by similar rules. And so I was there on the ground to both protest and, of course, see for myself what it looks like there in The Hague. And I talked to an activist, somebody who was protesting there, who's very interesting, and very interesting 22-year-old guy who gave up smoking cigarettes completely because of vaping. And I wanted him to tell his story. Also, by the way, do note that when he says that he vapes a lot, he does only vape 2 milligrams of nicotine. So this is not actually a very high dosage. He just, you know, wants to use his e-cigarette a lot. And a very fascinating guy. So let me just play what we recorded. What was the reason that you got into vaping? What was sort of the backstory? What happened that you got interested in e-cigarettes?
Well, I was on my way buying pack cigarettes when I was drunk, and I accidentally bought a starter kit with liquid. At first, I was like, "What is this? Like, I don't want it. I want my cigarettes." But after a while, I started using it because I have already paid money for it, and I kind of like it. And it started off from there. I started more vaping. I started looking up videos. I bought more expensive tanks. And I soon found out like I was going through a lot and a lot of liquids, like a lot, like 100 milliliters like per 3-4 days. So that's how I started making my own liquids. And after that, when all the noise from the EU and from the Dutch government about banning stuff, I also started making coils. Like, nobody can bend wire to make my coils. They can bend the coils, but if they make them themselves, they can't stop me. That's how I became the hobbyist.
That's pretty intense, and you showed me some stuff that you make yourself. It's very fascinating. Have you, like, how do the conversations with, like, your friends go with it when you stopped smoking cigarettes and started vaping? Did they know about it, or is it, like, is it common in your age group?
Oh, it's not common in my age group, but I have one friend, only one friend who vapes, but he also smokes. So it's not a serious vapor, but nobody actually gave kind of shit to say that, to the least. So, well, it's let be, they let me be. I don't disturb them, they don't disturb me.
So here the Dutch government is probably going to ban at least a certain set of vape flavors. So the politicians, they say that if we allow all these fancy flavors, then children will start vaping. Like, you know, like 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, because of the if we don't ban it, then they like the strawberry taste or whatever. Do you think that's a good argument?
No, because they're gonna do it anyway. Like, I started smoking when I was 15. I started drinking when I was 16. I smoked some weed when I was like around 17. Kids gonna try it anyway. But the main part is they can say they're gonna continue vaping. No, kids gonna try vaping. They're gonna try it a few times, and then they're gonna never do it again. So it's an argument based on flaws.
Yeah, I mean, when I started smoking, it was Red Marlboros, and the funny thing is that they want to keep the tobacco taste that they want to allow, which is the thing that reminds you of the thing that you wanted to stop.
Yes.
Yeah, it's the ironic situation.
Who wants to vape like? Who wants to smell like a tobacco? Who wants to smell like that?
Yeah, nobody. I mean, it completely doesn't make sense what they're doing here. And the problem seems to be that they want to use the Netherlands now as an example to talk about like replicating this on an EU level. Do you think if you didn't have the ability to make your liquids yourself that you would go back to smoking regular cigarettes if it was more difficult to vape?
Yes, it's way the way how much I vape is way too expensive, because I do it as a part of a hobby and a part of to stay off cigarettes. But if I can't make my own liquid, I am forced to start smoking again.
Yeah, and I think that's also going to be some of the consequences here. And then, that's the bad implications of this. Just one more thing I'm curious about. When you stopped smoking and then started just full-time vaping, how did you see, like, your health and, like, your overall health improve?
I can run up the stairs again without coughing and without I don't know how to say that in English. Like, your chest gets really tight. You are breathing for air, looking for air. I can just run. I can bike again. I can do everything without getting low in air.
And now let's get to the interview of this week. My guest this week is Israfil Özkan. He's the director of the Turkish Public Alcohol Policy Watch, a very long title there for an organization, but very interesting guy, very interesting thoughts on alcohol policy in Turkey and how exactly it influences consumer behavior. So listen into our chat. So Israfil, you are an expert on all things alcohol policy in Turkey and also based in Ankara, in the capital of Turkey. So first of all, give us a bit of an overview of what's been happening in Turkey in the last few months. I've spent some time in the country as well, so I got to know a bit of it. Of course, now speaking the language is a bit more complicated. What exactly were the alcohol policy rules that the government implemented during those lockdowns that we've had?
Thank you so much, Bill. Let me start a little before than last 2 months, because usually it's known that the government of Turkey is not a favor of any kind of liquor, and implementing a quite rigid alcohol ban since 2013, like curtailing advertisements and lacing restrictions on liquor selling hours, sort of restriction. Up until the start of the pandemic, the government continued to raise taxes on liquor while blocking license processes of liquor store and restaurants serving alcohol. However, the pandemic and the rising case numbers were a great opportunity for government to implement more and more measures on alcohol. Just 6 months ago, the Ministry of Interior issued a decree and announced a curfew and ban on a liquor sales on weekends in November 2020. The justification for the ban was that liquor was not an essential good, and it made social distancing more challenging to keep it. People were skeptical about the justification, of course, finding it hard to fathom how liquor affected the ability to social distance while they were sitting at their homes, under the curfew. This question was asked by many, yet the government succeeded to implement the ban until recently. This ban, sales ban on weekends, lasts 4 months. And then a couple of months ago, following the first ban, the pandemic peaked second time in Turkey, and the government announced another full lockdown for 17 days between April 30 to May 17, 2021. While full lockdown measures were in place, news had been circulating in social media. Liquor stores would face closures because they were not under any exemption, because the government has an exemption list and the liquor store was not on the list. So, however, in the circular letter on total closure measures, and usually sent by the Ministry of Interior to all provincial governorships, and we checked the letter, and there were no restrictions mentioned on liquor stalls, liquor sales within the scope of lockdown measures, which meant there was no legal basis for the liquor ban. Of course, everybody started to criticize the government, and everybody started to look for a legal ground for that. But the government were decisive and tried to put a ban on liquor without any legal grounds or logic. Together with heavy taxes and measures imposed on alcoholic products in recent years, the government failed to answer why a full-scale ban on alcohol would effectively combat the pandemic. So all these caused a justified concern on whether the government's rather restrictive alcohol policy would constitute a lifestyle intervention in the public opinion. So it will take this critics would go went go crazy. I can say that.
Right. And are you aware of some of the adverse side effects of these kind of rules? Like, what did people do alternatively to get to alcohol, and have you seen a black market develop? Like, what is the consumer response to these kind of direct bans on buying alcohol?
Not just with the pandemic, but before the pandemic, Turkey has a tax for consuming luxury stuff, and alcohol is one of them. And every 6 months, the tax rates are increasing regularly. So alcohol prices already too high in Turkey comparing the purchasing power. We have been monitoring the alcohol black market and consumer reactions concerning the alcohol restriction in Turkey. We have a platform called Turkish Public Alcohol Policy Watch. So every year, we started last year, and we are monitoring the data. So there is a huge black market concerning the alcohol in Turkey, and it's just not limited with the alcohol, but also cigarettes and drugs or guns or bullets and whatever you like, and it's getting bigger and bigger every year. So people, there are two ways to react to all these bans. One of them is that there are people are more and more demanding alcohol from black market. So black market is getting bigger every year. The other one is that people are trying to brew their own beer or alcohol in their homes. So these are two main reactions. Every year, 3,000 people were under arrest because of the illegal alcohol trade. And last year, in the last 3 months of 2020, 92 people were people died because of the wrong recipe, because of the using illicit alcohol consumption.
We see this throughout Europe, is when you increase prices, you create sort of a quasi-prohibition for people on low incomes, because while people on higher incomes will still be able to stomach an additional tax, the lower income people who spend a larger amount of their overall income on consumption goods, including alcohol, of course, are disproportionately hit by these measures and will revert to trying to get different ways of getting alcohol. In terms of the motivations of the government, is it your view that in many European countries, we restrict alcohol, make it more expensive because the government says, well, it's not good for you, and there's like a health implication of that. Do you think there's additional reasons to why the Turkish government is cracking down on alcohol?
Yeah, I wish it would look like a European government, but it doesn't look like that. We made a comparative analysis between European countries and Turkey. World Health Organization, all other European countries, they're just trying to fight against the excessive use of alcohol. Per person, average European countries, per person alcohol consumption like 20 liters or 15 liters. So there are some logic behind the restrictive alcohol policy of WHO or some European countries, because the excessive use of alcohol, averagely 15 or 20 liters per person in a year, you can say there are some logic behind it, and they are using some way to reduce the alcohol consumption. But those regulations are not as hard as in Turkey. But Turkey, per person alcohol consumption, like 1.4 liter in a year. Comparing in an average European countries, Turkey doesn't have any kind of excessive alcohol use problem or alcoholism. So, but even though Turkey is taking the hardest restriction on the alcohol, and they are showing European countries as an excuse for us, look at the European countries. They are using the same. They are using the same restriction on the alcohol. This is a huge manipulation in Turkey. So we are frequently underlying this difference between European countries and Turkey, because Turkey doesn't have an excessive use of alcohol.
Yeah. How has alcohol consumption changed over time in Turkey? I know that the national hero of Turkey, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, was a bit of a hedonist himself. He liked to drink. That was publicly known. Has it changed over time? Would you say that in your lifetime so far, that the habits of when, like how much alcohol is being consumed, has that statistically or like from your impression, has that changed significantly in Turkey?
Yeah, let me put it this way. The first one, especially in the last 20 years, the public appearances of alcohol has changed, because you can't see alcohol on TVs, on newspapers, or you can see a glass in a hand of a politician or any famous people in TVs. It's totally illegal right now. So alcohol, this is the first part. But in general, we have data only for last 40 years. I can say that it's not from the local sources. Because we don't have any information or data how much alcohol consumption rate in Turkey, but we have data from World Health Organization or World Bank, and it a little bit decreased. I think in 1919, per person alcohol consumption in a year, like 2 liter, but now 1.4 liter. So nothing has changed. But Before that, before AKP, and when you check the newspapers or see TVs, you can see a lot of politicians having receptions, drinking alcohol, drinking especially champagne, or talking about the benefits of beer or wine, sort of news, and especially TVs and movies, and you can see a lot of liquor. But now it's totally illegal, and it's even a crime right now if you drink alcohol in front of a public, and especially they are some, if they children or young people among the crowd, there's a crime for that.
So we're getting to the end of this segment, Israfil, as sort of a conclusion. Your organization, what are you actively arguing to change right now in the alcohol policy rules? What are, in your view, what are rule changes that you think you could be successful in getting the government to reconsider?
Actually, we already did something, and we are really proud of it. So I'm sending emails to all our partners. In the last full lockdown, and we were looking for a legal basis for alcohol ban, but we couldn't find it. So we started to make a campaign with social media influencers and journalists and some companies. We said that there is no legal ground for this alcohol ban, so you can't do that. This is a fundamental right. You need a law to restrict it, but you don't have it. So you can't do that with a press conference. And so the lockdown lasted like 17 days. And in the first 7 days, we organized a huge campaign, and we said that we will not obey this ban because there's no legal basis for it. So we forced, not forced, but we made a campaign, do not obey the ban. It reached almost 5 million people in just one day. So companies continue to sell alcohol, and people continue to buy alcohol. First 7 days, alcohol sales were possible in the full lockdown. So government did a lot of statement about that the ban is still continuous, blah blah blah, but they couldn't succeed. So for at least 7 days, people were free to use their fundamental rights. So we did it, and actually we were a part of a huge company campaign. So just for that, but other than that, we are trying to do this thing. Alcohol is a controversial issue in Turkey, like many other issues. So there are no organized voices, organized reaction in Turkey. And in every controversial topics, there are just only a few groups, or usually government try to marginalize them so they can't reach broader audience. So but this time in alcohol issue, we try to change this perspective. So in a mainstream organization, we try to promote a fundamental right. That we said that we didn't promote alcohol itself, but we said that drinking, buying, or selling alcohol is a fundamental right. You need a law to restrict it, but even the law cannot allow you to a fundamental right without any logical explanation. So we hold on that logic, and we made and then we brought together people. Those people are not even they're not interested in any kind of politics. They're just people who like drinking beer with friends or having a house party in a lockdown. So we reached those people. So it was a huge success. So the biggest achievement would be or bring together all those non-politics, but only ordinary people who are drinking alcohol, or at least even though they don't drink, but they'd like to have a right to drink or right to sell. It doesn't matter. So we brought together all those people. So this time, on a controversial issue, the general public opinion was that you can't do that. This isn't right. So we did it, and now we are trying to expand this coalition, and we are trying to build a separate platform and its own projects, and maybe reaching more people, etc. But It was a huge success for us on a controversial issue to reach a broader audience in a country polarized, but we did it. So we are trying to expand this coalition right now.
And that concludes this week's episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for Israfil Özkan for coming on the podcast. You can find his Twitter handle and the Twitter handle of his organization in the description of this podcast. As always, if you like this podcast, please like and subscribe. And also make sure that if you want to buy us a coffee, you can make a donation on consumerchoicecenter.org/donate. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz. See you Thursday. You have-